This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 24 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And Max is currently lost in probably the Bermuda Triangle or something along those lines.
At this point, I'm pretty sure Section 31 has him.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe we'll do an investigation and we'll be able to get our cameras into some place that no one's ever been and and see if we might be able to find him.
Yes, in search of Max. Perfect.
Yes. But this week is part 3 in our series on Leonard Nimoy as a television star, where we're going to be looking at his 4th television series, In Search Of. Now, this is a bit different from the other shows which we've discussed in that it's not a performance per se. He's the host of a show. Next week, same deal. But the show which he hosted was In Search Of, which aired from 1976 to 1982. And John, can you describe In Search Of for those people who may not know what it is?
I sure can. In Search Of was a brilliant show that was an exploration of every crackpot theory that was needed to fill syndication time on a lazy Saturday afternoon.
Yes. Yes. It's would you say a docuseries?
It's sort of like an early Oliver Stone take on reality. So, yeah, okay.
In a sense, yeah.
Yeah, docudrama.
Right, where it investigates the mysteries of the world, you know?
Yes, with brilliantly performed recreations
of
historical circumstances.
Yeah, this is kind of like Leonard Nimoy's Rescue 911.
Oh, my gosh, you're right. Once again, Nimoy beat him to the punch. You're absolutely right.
Yep. But this one's a little more out there, I guess. If Rescue 911 is sort of like the ER of infotainment or whatever they would call it,
yeah,
In Search Of is the X-Files of infotainment, I would say.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. Now, Nimoy hosted this and like you were saying, there are a lot of recreations and stuff like that, but the way a typical episode would go is that they'd say, like, the Loch Ness Monster, you know, for years people have wondered what is going on out there. Well, now new evidence has come to light, and our cameras have gone somewhere where no cameras have gone before, and we are going to, you know, figure out or try to figure out what's going on. And then they talk to a lot of people who have the inside track. Lots of times there's blurred out faces or whatever to protect these people from the government who's going to, you know, do whatever they're going to do to them. And, you know, for the most part, it seems like it's just narrated by Nimoy. And then there might be one or two shots of him at some place, like, you know, getting out of a truck or something like that, saying, yeah, this is where it happened. This is where it happened.
Yeah, like coming back from the breaks or something like that, just to establish that he actually was there for some reason.
Yeah, and didn't just do the entire thing from his house.
Yeah.
Right. And, they talk to all these people and everything. It's not Nimoy talking to them. It's some other person talking to them, you know?
Yeah, but they're... Yeah, they're off mic, and so it's always some sort of snippet, like watching one of the... You know what? It sort of is reminiscent of... Do you remember A Current Affair?
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah. It, sort of like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. It's weird. What do you think about the show?
Well, I have a tremendous nostalgic attachment to it because it was on syndication, and there were many a Saturday where it was that time in between what happened in the morning and what happened in the evening. Most people call it afternoon. I just called it dead time. And you desperately search through television looking for something. There were so many fewer channels and shows back then, kids. It was crazy. And I mean, the thing is, it was like an oasis. It really still kind of is from that nostalgic perspective, because it's so much fun to get back into that spirit. Like going back and rewatching some episodes for this, I was able to plug back into that sense of wonder that was so much easier, I guess, for me as a kid. But I think that in general, before the internet sort of drained the life out of knowledge, like the fun part of knowledge seeking, it really has. It's become too cold, I guess. Like, these shows were great because they were purely speculative, and it was, you know, here's a scientist who thinks that the Loch Ness Monster might have come from another planet. And it's like, oh, I don't really believe that, but this is fun. It's like telling campfire stories.
Yeah, it is strange. You know, I had never really seen it up until now. I had heard of it for sure. But I had never, I was like familiar with what it was, but I had never sat down to watch it. But I have seen shows like this. And when watching it, I sort of instantly got the impression that I knew exactly how this show went, you know, on a regular basis. And, you know, it felt very familiar to me, even though I hadn't actually seen this show itself. Whether or not this was the first of its kind or somewhere in the middle, I'm not 100% positive, but it doesn't really matter, I guess. The thing about it is, it's like you watch these things. Like one of the episodes that I watched was, I think, probably the most popular episode of the show, or one of the most popular based on what I was reading, and that's the episode on UFO cover-ups.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you see these people, and they're talking about, you know, what the weather balloon really was, and how, you know, their dad was there working on the Air Force base or whatever it was, and all this other stuff. And these people have these supposedly, you know, really, really solid credentials. And you hear them say what they have to say. And what they have to say isn't really much, you know? There's yeah. not really a lot of info there, but they're considered to be experts, and the way that they talk, they have so much sort of belief in what they're saying
yeah.
that I watch it and I think, like, this must be true, because how could they make this up? They're obviously, like, the details are so small and so exact
yeah.
that there's no way that these guys are not telling the truth. And what does that mean? I mean, like, I came out of that episode thinking, like, there really were aliens that crash landed in Roswell and all this stuff.
Tommy Lee Jones was there. You've seen the pictures.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about, you know, my rational thought when I'm watching these things, but it just sort of goes right out the window. And then as soon as the credits roll, I take a step back and I'm like, wait a minute. No, what they're saying, they're not really saying anything, you know?
I have a theory
that
the synthesizer music is done at just the right frequency to disable your rational thought while you're watching.
Oh, that could be. That could be. That makes sense.
Because that synthesizer music is hypnotic. You
yeah.
can't walk away from that stuff. And it's like, I would love to have it playing in the background anytime I have a meeting at work.
Mm-hmm.
Just because everybody will just listen to everything I have to say, and then I can just walk out of the room.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't know. I mean, part of it is just the manipulation. I mean, you brought up Oliver Stone earlier. Yeah. And, you know, I remember being in film school, and I had a teacher who was talking about JFK, and he was trying to show us how, you know, like, the editing in that movie sort of reinforces the thinking of revelation when in reality they're not really saying anything, you know? And mm-hmm. like they pointed out to a scene between Kevin Costner and Donald Sutherland where, you know, the guy, I forget the investigator's name, the DA's name, but he's talking to Mr. X, right? And
Jim Garrison. Sorry,
Jim
that's
Garrison.
Who he was playing.
Yeah, yeah. There you go, Jim Garrison. He's talking to Mr. X, and you know, he's like, "I've got information for you, Garrison." And Garrison's like, "What is it?" And he's like, "No one is asking the right questions. Why did this happen? Why did this happen? Why did this happen?" And Garrison's like writing down this information, like, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah," but he's not giving any information. He's just asking questions in a compelling fashion, you know.
Yep.
And it's like, that's kind of what's going on here. Like, there's a scene in that UFO cover-up thing where they're like, "We're going to get to go into the vault in, like, room 19 or something like that, which no one has ever been in before." And they keep on, like, showing a shot of, like, a door. And I guess they go in. I don't remember them being in. But they're like, it does have air-conditioned units, which everyone assumed was used for storing bodies. You know?
Yep.
And then they talk to like some dude who works at the base and he's like, "Oh yeah, they use that to cool down engines to like super cold temperatures so that they can test them out, starting them up, you know, from a cold start or something like that." And it's like, that's a completely reasonable explanation for why
Isn't
they have
it
big
just,
refrigerators.
Yeah. Just makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. But and it's like, that's all that they have, you know? Like, they talk to these guys and they're like, "Well, I saw this thing, you know? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, what does that mean? Where's your evidence, you know? You know, I talked to a guy, and he said he saw this thing." And it's like, you're not saying anything, really. You're not. And who's to say that that guy's not telling the truth or telling the truth or whatever?
Yeah, but see, this is really, I think you hit on it, where truth isn't necessarily the right word. It's belief.
Yeah.
The people that are talking are convinced that what they're telling you is true.
Yeah.
That's what makes them compelling. So in truth never really enters into it. It's simply one possible explanation, as they say in the credits. They're not trying to say it's the only explanation, just one of many.
That's what they say in the credits, but I think that's just to cover their own butts. I don't know.
I have a feeling that the legal team saw the first episode and went, "Oh, whoa, whoa, hold on, guys. We got to put something in front here."
Yeah. It is like, I've been trying to think of what it's like, but what you were saying right there, it's, did you see Room 237, the documentary about The Shining?
Yes, I did. Those people are bat-ass crazy.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, like, Max is a huge fan of that movie, and his whole thing is like, you gotta watch it, because these people are all freaking insane,
they
you know?
Are,
it's
they
so
are nuts.
Great. He's like, I wish that what they were saying made even the slightest bit of sense, because it would be amazing if it were true, you know?
Yep. wouldn't it just be amazing?
Yeah.
It's that's a good poll. Room 237 is extremely apropos to cite for something like this. And I actually, just while we're talking, I think you're right. You said it doesn't matter whether In Search Of was the very first show of its type. I think that it still spawned all of the imitators that we came to see later, including Hollywood Babylon with Tony Curtis, which was the most fascinating. It was the most fascinatingly awful conspiracy show ever.
Okay, I hadn't heard of that one. I was thinking of Hollywood Babylon with Kevin Smith and Ralph Garman.
No. Hollywood Babylon with Tony Curtis. Do yourself a favor and find a copy of it and watch it. And it's just, my buddy Joey and I used to just make merciless fun of it, because it was so obviously just a cash grab for him, you know, to stay afloat.
I never knew the reason why that podcast was titled that way, and now I know. Wow, you learn something new every day.
There you go.
Or was it? I guess we'll never know.
In Beast Search Of Why Kevin Smith Called It That.
But yeah, I mean, it is kind of like, I really see it as, in addition to being sort of like a forebearer of these shows or whatever. I also see it as being sort of like, like I mentioned before, kind of like a precursor to the X-Files. Yeah. Like, while I was watching this thing on the UFO cover-ups and everything, I'm like, this is structured and everything very similarly to the way an episode of the X-Files is structured, only that's clearly fiction. But even like the way that the X-Files ends is always like, is this the truth? Did this happen? We don't know. You know, that kind of thing.
The truth is out there.
The truth is out there, exactly. And I guarantee you Chris Carter watched a ton of In Search Of.
Yeah, well, wasn't Kolchak the Night Stalker? Wasn't that contemporary with In Search Of?
It had to have been, yeah.
Yeah, late 70s. Mm-hmm. So, and so basically, yeah, there's no doubt that Chris Carter was bored on a Saturday afternoon just the same way we were.
And even like sort of the range of topics which the X-Files deals with seems to be similar to the range of topics that In Search Of deals with. You've got the UFO stuff, you've got the government conspiracies, but then you've also got things like the Loch Ness Monster and that sort of thing, you know, and weird natural phenomena that don't make any sense. You know?
Although I will say that since Nimoy was the host, I was surprised to revisit the Jack the Ripper episode and not have him forward the plot from the original series and say, no, guys, we figured it out. He was an evil spirit.
Yeah. It's strange. I mean, getting on that for just a second there, you know, Wolf in the Fold, we talked to a guy very early on in this series who owns a bookstore in town, which focuses on just history and mystery. And he is a semi-famous ripperologist, as they call them. And I was unaware that Robert Bloch, who wrote Wolf in the Fold, and who also, you know, wrote Psycho, the novel Psycho.
Yeah.
He is apparently really big into Jack the Ripper stuff and has actually written a number of books about Jack the Ripper.
Oh, wow. I'm going to put that on my reading list. I didn't know that.
It's very strange, but
cool.
But regardless of that, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, speaking of Leonard Nimoy being in this and kind of segueing into that, his involvement in this show seems rather strange for a couple of reasons. I mean, well, first off, what do you think about his, shall we call it, performance in this show?
He's an MC more than a host. He's the one, he comes out with the flourish and presents the next crazy act for you, and he does it with a real relish, like, and you know, the same professionalism that you come to expect from Leonard Nimoy and everything. But honestly, he's really there because of the paycheck. I mean, it's like I really think somebody like Leonard Nimoy just eventually got to a point where he was like, yeah, okay, this is fine, sure, all right.
It really does sort of seem like that. I mean, given the time period and everything, you got to figure this is in between the original series and the movies. So it was right when he was probably needing that paycheck. It was before all those contracts were renegotiated and stuff like that. So he probably was in search of money. And this seemed like a good fit. Now, I can understand why they would want him, because he's a science fiction icon and everything like that. And also, you know, as Spock, you know, his voice sort of lends credibility to whatever is being said, you know?
Yeah, yeah, he brings that sense of believability that instantly gets transferred. It's sort of like, I've always reasoned out, for instance, that like Bryan Cranston was perfect casting for Breaking Bad because we all already had him in mind as a father. Mm-hmm. Figure from Malcolm in the Middle. So it was perfect to carry him over, and he was able to pull that off. So it's perfect to carry over, you know, a guy who was essentially the embodiment of serious, thoughtful science fiction and put him in front of this, because you immediately hear his voice and it triggers that thing in your brain that's like, oh, well, okay, well, I'll listen to you. What are you talking about? And so, yeah, I think it definitely immediately gives credibility to the show.
Yeah, but now on the flip side of that, you know, what about it from his perspective? Now, I mean, yes, I understand that we all need to work and we all need to pay the bills. But his involvement in this movie or this show seems really weird, because going back to the original series and even the thing that we talked about with the animated series and how he, you know, stuck his neck out for the other people, and looking at all of the stuff which he's done since then, which obviously is a bit different because he's got enough money and clout where he can sort of do what he wants. But yeah, he always seems to be the guy who's pushing the content forward, the guy who's saying, like, now, you know, let's not just do this because we're doing it. Let's actually do it right. And for him to sort of agree to do something like this seems a little weird, because it doesn't seem like he would really buy into these theories. I could see him saying, like, oh, yeah, well, these are good questions to ask. But the way that the show is presented is much more sensational. And I really can't reconcile the fact that he would be involved with something like this.
I can, easily. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You know what? Because mindsets were different. I really do think this is very much the asking a question, even an outlandish question, was not there. There wasn't this knee jerk pile on attack mentality back then. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sitting here pining for yesteryear or anything like that, but people were willing to sort of be, here's a contextual cue, is Chariots of the Gods was big back then.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is your toehold for why a show like this, where even somebody who likes to approach things from a more intellectual standpoint, Chariots of the Gods, which is a complete work of asshattery, like, that was enough in the cultural zeitgeist. You're in the middle of the space race, you're in the middle of a need. I mean, the Cold War, was especially in the 70s, was a freaky thing. So to sit there and ask these questions that were any sort of mental escape at all, to give you an exercise to think about something seriously, like, at the end of In Search Of, sure, they present it sensationally, but hopefully you could watch it with your family and you guys could have a discussion about it afterward. It was basically discussion television.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had entertainment value outside of its running time. And I think that in and of itself would have brought somebody like Nimoy to the fold to say, you know what, we're going to give people a reason to sit around and talk and think. You know, so what if the show's a little sensational? Maybe there's a positive side to come out of that.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. I mean, I guess I could see that more than, you know, something like, let's say, Rescue 911 or something along those lines. And just for the record or whatever, I was just reading on IMDb that apparently this show was kind of a spinoff of two documentaries that they did on TV called In Search of Ancient Astronauts, which was obviously based on the Chariots of the Gods, and In Search of Ancient Mysteries. So there you go. I don't really know if Nimoy was involved with either of those things, but yeah. But yeah, okay, I guess not, because it says here Robert Vaughn narrated the pilot episode but declined to host the series. Rod Serling narrated the initial television specials, but died before the regular series began. So there you go.
Oh, interesting. So Nimoy becomes his successor.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then I could, then, you know what, knowing that now, I could easily see Nimoy approaching this from that sort of Twilight Zone mentality of, here's an opportunity to do something that is, again, thought-provoking.
Yeah.
The way Twilight Zone was. It doesn't matter if it's fiction or not. Mm-hmm. It's going to get people talking.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I guess that makes sense. It just still seems a little strange. I don't know. Knowing it now, I mean, like, I think that if the show were to be made now, he would not be involved. But then again, maybe that will be proven wrong next week. I don't know.
if it were made now, maybe Shatner would be the host.
Oh, yeah. Shatner would definitely do it. I have no doubt in my mind that Shatner would do it. Yeah, for sure.
It probably hurt him a little bit that they didn't ask him.
Yes, that's true. So, any final thoughts on In Search Of?
It's a joy. And I God bless everybody that put it on YouTube. And, you know, you know what? Do yourselves a favor, everybody. I'm going to specifically call out the Jack the Ripper episode because it was so much fun to watch it with all of the videotape flaws on it. Like, wow, that's like listening to an old scritchy record on vinyl. And you hear those pops and those hisses, and you remember the tracking problems and having to get up and adjust your VCR and everything. It really transports you to yesteryear.
Yeah, I need to watch that Jack the Ripper episode. There were so many, like that and the Marilyn Monroe episode and stuff like that, where I was like, oh, you know, I just didn't have the time to watch all of them. So,
well, be sure to catch Siberian Fireball as well. That's a fun one.
Okay, yeah, I missed that when I was skimming through the titles, but oh yeah. Well. It's definitely entertaining. You know, you can definitely watch it and not be bored, especially since they're so short and everything like that. But, you know, after I'm done with it, I'm kind of like, that was kind of crap, you know. So
it's popcorn television.
I guess that's true. I guess that's what it was. Yeah. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Not at all.
Once in a while. Yeah. One other thing, which I didn't realize until we started putting this series together and everything like that, I just now came to the realization that NERD's first album is named after this show. It's called In Search Of, and you know they're obviously really into Leonard Nimoy and everything. The name of their production company is Star Tracks, and their little company hand gesture is a modified Vulcan salute. Yeah. You can find an interview online of Pharrell Williams where he interviews Leonard Nimoy, and it's awesome. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it. I've seen the picture of them where you can tell that like he's just having a complete geek out fanboy moment where he's like, I'm meeting Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, it's a pretty good interview and everything. It's just so weird because Pharrell is just like, you could tell he's just like completely tongue-tied and starstruck, and he just doesn't know what to do with himself, you know, because he's talking to Leonard Nimoy. But
I'll have to look that up.
But I never once put together the fact that they named their first album after Leonard Nimoy's weird, crazy infotainment show.
And it's a great album, too.
It's a very great album.
Now they need to release an album called Commentary Trek Stars because we're the ones that piece it together. We're Ready Player One for NERD.
Yeah, I'm sure we're the first people to piece that together too. Yeah.
Well, hey, I didn't hear it on any other recordings. Therefore, we are.
All right, works for me. Yeah. All right. Well, moving on to some other kind of Star Trek creator related news. You know, this new movie, it's upon us, and there's been a few announcements or revelations about who's working on it that I figured, you know, we could note. I mean, the big one, which I don't think we talked about, was Idris Elba. He's apparently going to be the villain.
Has that been 100% confirmed, or is it just that he went in for like a screen test and somebody sort of leaked it?
No, it was in Variety. Said he's in talks, and when Variety says you're in talks, that's pretty much means that's happening. So
yeah, you're not reading it on Latino Review,
right? Exactly. And you know, when I mean, there was some speculation that this would be about Klingons and that he would be, you know, a Klingon, but Simon Pegg said that he's not a Klingon. But when asked if he was in the movie, he's like, "Yeah, I heard something about that. Yeah, you know, I think he's going to be in it, but not as a Klingon." And then he's like, or maybe he will be. I don't know, he said. So, you know, so that's kind of cool.
Oh, he's a fantastic actor. You know, it's that they're bringing the talent, so good.
And then they cast another person in the movie. Sophia Boutella is apparently going to have a major role. She played Gazelle in Kingsman, who was the lady with the blades for legs or feet or whatever. She was pretty cool in that movie. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I haven't had the opportunity. But I've heard there's only one person I know that didn't like it. So that's my own personal Rotten Tomatoes. That's about a solid 92%.
That's good. Drew hated it. Drew from Standard Orbit.
Well, that makes two people. So my personal Rotten Tomatoes has now gone down to 86.5%. Way to ruin it for me, Mike.
Oh, well, sorry. Well, I think it's probably the best movie of the year so far. You know?
Oh, wow.
The only movie which I would say comes close to it, and I would probably go back and forth on that, is Furious 7, which is noteworthy because it looks like a substantial amount of the crew from Furious 7 is going to be working on the new Star Trek movie, including the cinematographer Stephen F. Winton. And the costume designer, Sanja Milkovic Hayes, who worked on Insurrection, by the way. It's kind of cool.
Well, the thing is, there was nothing wrong with how Insurrection looked. So, cool.
There you go.
But, I'm always actually happy to hear when a director is working with a cinematographer they've worked with before, because there really is a shorthand that they can... speak to each other with. You can tell when it's somebody's first time with someone. And so that's good news. And, whatever anybody may think of, the Furious franchise, they've looked good.
Yeah, for sure. And this guy, he's shot every movie that Justin Lin has directed since Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. And with the exception of... the Bruce Lee one, which is the name, Finishing the Game. Bruce Lee, the search for the new Bruce Lee, whatever it is.
Okay.
So he didn't do that. He did everything else. So it makes sense that he would just, I'm kind of waiting to see who he's going to get as his editors, since, those movies have 15,000 editors. I'm really hoping Christian Wagner, because that guy's amazing. He's edited some of the best edited movies of all time. So
how much would it bend your mind if the plot was that the villain had to steal 50 of the 50 Starfleet shuttles, and Kirk was trying to stop him from doing it, and they had a big chase at the end they were racing shuttles outside the back of the Enterprise trying to steal them all.
It was someone on, I think, the Babel conference who came up with the title, Star Trek Tachyon Drift.
I love it.
Oh, man. Yeah, they got to do that.
Cut it, print it, and sell it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, it's good. And just in kind of, in terms of, like, how this movie might look or whatever, Justin Lin and Stephen Winton are two guys who have made a ton of blockbusters in the past few years that have been in 2D and shot on film. So this could have a very sort of classical look to it.
So we don't have any read yet on whether they're going to do any sort of IMAX sequences or anything like that. Has anything like that leaked yet?
No, I kind of think they won't. For one thing, it would be pricey. They might, but when Orsi was directing it, they were going to shoot it digitally. I don't know if that's the case anymore or not. I'm guessing that they'll make it 3D, whether Lin and company want it to be 3D or not. Because that's just, if they did that for JJ, they're going to do it for this one.
I can't believe that's still a thing.
It's weird. It's weird.
It's insane. It's just nobody's even.
I think it's mainly for the foreign markets, honestly. There's a number of movies. Well, Furious 7 is one of them, where they converted it to 3D just for overseas, just for, I think, China. China is the big place. 3D is huge in China.
Really?
They converted Noah into 3D for China.
Wow.
It's weird.
That is... Okay. Well, all right. Yeah. I guess that makes sense then. If you got to convert it anyway, why not go ahead?
Yeah. They did the same thing with the last Hunger Games movie. And now the next Hunger Games movie is being converted because for the U.S. as well, which is, I don't know how to feel about that, but whatever.
Yeah.
It's always a guessing game. Anytime a new movie comes out, I always try to find interviews with the directors where it's like, do you want this to be in 3D, or did they force your hand? Did you have anything to do with it being in 3D? And it's really hard to figure that out because obviously you're not going to get a bunch of people who are there to sell a movie, saying, don't see it in 3D,
Right.
but whatever.
Yes, that's very. Oh, you know, I'd say Nolan's the one director that would be like, if they tried to screw with him that way, he'd be like, oh hell no.
There's a few who have come out and been like, no. But some of them have been a little, you know. I mean, JJ, you know, at first he was like, they can do whatever they want with it as long as we shoot it in 2D. And then he kind of softened and he's like, we saw some sequences and we're like, this looks pretty cool. I'm kind of. But then you hear a few little things and it's like, yeah, I don't think he likes the 3D. I really don't think he cares.
Yeah, it's just somebody pointed to the clause in his contract.
Yeah. But now, what can you do? Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see with this one, whether or not it'll be 3D or whether or not we should watch it in 3D. I don't know. So that's exciting. Exciting times for the new Star Trek movie and the creators involved and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
One other thing I just want to mention in regards to Thomas and our Deep Space Nine recommendations.
Ah, yes.
I sent him an email about this, but just for the record, there are three episodes, or I guess technically four episodes, that I thought of where I was like, you know, we should have said this because they're perfect. The number one for sure is the Maquis parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Because even if he doesn't like Deep Space Nine, the whole point of that two-parter was to set up Voyager. So he's getting Voyager backstory at the very least. But in addition to that, I really think that that two-parter is one of the first instances of Deep Space Nine finding its voice that it would have for the next, you know, 4 years or 5 years or whatever it was. You know,
good point.
That's the one where, you know, they flat out say, like, you know, for the Federation is a paradise and it's easy to be an angel in paradise, you know, and they took that line and ran with it for the next 6 years and made the show into what it was.
Yeah.
So that I think, if you want a good sense of what Deep Space Nine is, but you also want a nice in for, you know, your Voyager thing, then that's that. But two other episodes which I thought of, which might be good if you're a TOS fan, just for fun, more than anything else, are Blood Oath, where you get the three Klingons, Kor, Kang, and Koloth.
Oh, yes. Yes. Blood Oath is, yes, I forgot the show title, but yes, that is an amazing episode.
It's pretty cool. I mean, it doesn't really have much to do with the rest of DS9, but just to see these three dudes together again, you know, same actors and everything. I mean, an original series fan should love it, you know. And the other one that I would say is Crossover, the first Mirror Universe episode. Just because, I mean, I think that's a great episode on its own, but also, like, it answers the question of what happened when Spock tried to change things in the Mirror Universe.
You're right. It does. And I also am a big fan of Mirror Universe Kira.
Yeah.
So,
that's just me. Yeah. So definitely check those three out as well, Thomas, or those four. So, yeah.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for listening, for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about In Search Of today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It's not an overstatement, and you had said in your introduction that without him and his hand guiding all of this, then it's unlikely that 2 would have been what it was. And if it had not been successful, then it probably would have meant the end of Star Trek at that point.
Earl Grey.
Like, I'm expecting Ricardo Martavan to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5.
The shuttlecraft. The orb.
Curzon is involved with the Kittimer Accords. Spock is at Kittimer when those are being talked about, so you would think they would have run into each other.
They probably
at least
hung out in the bar together.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out now! The Ready Room.
The movie series would not have relaunched and become what it was if not for the amazing
bounce of the Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan was to Star Trek the same thing that the Best of Both Worlds was to Next Generation.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, I always liked the... I like that episode for... I mean, it's one of the most derided of the original series episodes, but yet I always... It has this place in my heart for some reason. I've always enjoyed watching it over. So I wanted to do something with those guys, the Excalibians.
The 602 Club. Like, I could kind of dismiss Droids in Distress and Fight or Flight and everything like that, and I was just kind of watching the background, but all of a sudden I started catching myself... like stopping working and just focusing on watching, and so it just got better and better and better, and I think I was hooked by episode 4, Breaking Ranks. That's when I was like, okay, I like this show, this is good. Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign, and in the Arcanus campaign a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. One way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to help us out in other ways, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Just go to itunes.com/trekfm and you can find all of our shows over there. And you can leave us a review, which would be helpful. We would appreciate it a lot. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact and leave us an email that way. You can also leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and you can leave us a voicemail there. On Twitter, you can contact us at trekfm. On Facebook, at facebook.com/trekfm, and also on Facebook you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. So, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on the internet at Kessel Junkie on the Twitter. And you can also find me co-hosting a show called Words with Nerds, also available through iTunes and Stitcher and et cetera, et cetera. It's my buddy Craig and myself with deep thoughts about the nerd and geek community.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can also find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. And you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew, where we talk about the original series. Or you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com with Max and Brandon, where we do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic, where we talk about whatever the hell we want to talk about.
Yes.
All right. So that's it for Leonard Nimoy's first hosting gig on television. And we will be back next week to discuss the final television show which he starred in, which was another hosting gig, Ancient Mysteries.